thanks for having me here. This is fantastic. It's an honor to be here talking with Chris. I was going to start off by just describing one of the things that Alex and I, who's also Jordan, two guys up here, got, you know, came up and said, yeah, and along with Nick, got it, you know, came to me with the idea for doing it. One of the things that's been so successful about it is that I would say, and you know, we go back and forth on the exact estimates, but I would say about half of the people that have bought the book and read it are people that don't really read all that often. And part of it is that I didn't in any way try to curb my ADD when coming up with, you know, yeah, just kind of let things flow out there. And so it becomes a very quick read for a lot of people that normally would never pick up a book. And I've heard that from a lot of people. You know, hey, it's, you know, I don't read at all, but pick this up. And so it's a it's an interesting format. I think being so short and all over the place without sort of any kind of, you know, cohesive pattern actually sort of works for trying to get out of, you know, just the literary community for the people that do a lot of reading. And to some degree, it's been successful with that. So I'm just going to read a few passages here, and then we can get into, and then Chris, I think, is going to talk a while, and then we can get into question and answer or discussion or however we want to use up our hour. So I'm just going to start by describing what it's like sort of in some of our observation posts, which are there's bases of varying size from the major bases that have 20, 30,000 people on it and have everything that a city would have, to smaller bases that maybe a company occupies that have, you know, maybe even, you know, a little bit of running water, a few anemones, to just a couple people in an abandoned house spending, you know, a week or so or a couple days at a time. And that's what we were in, just 8 of us, for 3 days. There is no running water or electricity. We urinate into a pipe. Where it goes, I don't know. And we crap into bags, which we throw out the window. Without a breeze, the heat can be irksome, and the extensive rat population can create quite a ruckus as it tenaciously seeks sustenance in this concrete celebration of the austere. Surprisingly, we actually enjoy going there for our rotation because it is a pleasant break from the rest of the company. We relish the autonomy. We smoke a hookah, laugh, and relax while away from the critical eye of our superiors. So we had a blast, my squad and I, kicking back and reveling in our squalor. When we were not smoking hookah or shooting at rats, we rotated in and out of posts on the roofs and watched for insurgent activity. My first shift was uneventful. I gazed at empty streets for an hour, only seeing a few military convoys and several curfew violators who were out trying to position themselves on the gas line prior to the dawn rush. The fuel shortage is a crisis here, with motorists sometimes waiting in line for 24 hours or more. During my second shift on the roof, I heard an explosion from the northwest, followed by a whistling sound that passed fleetingly overhead. My initial thought was that a roadside bomb had gone off and a piece of shrapnel had flown by, humming as it had spun through the hot air. To the northwest, I saw a cloud of dust in the courtyard of a bombed-out mosque, dome and walls riddled with the acne scars of a fierce gun battle fought during the push from Fallujah. Recognizing what it was, I picked up the radio and reported that a rocket-propelled grenade, RPG, had just flown by. I never saw the individual who fired it. You rarely do. Despite popular myth, the insurgents are not suicidal. They are victims of that cumbersome, unshakable need for self-preservation, just like the rest of us. They pop out from around a corner, quickly fire a few rounds or a rocket, and vanish back into the populace before you even know where the shots came from. We can't even get good descriptions of them after an incident because the people in the area are terrified of the Muj, which is short for Mujahideen, and usually deny even hearing the blast or the gunshots. And certainly they didn't see anything. I don't blame them. They know that if they cooperate with us, the Muj will kill their families, and we can't do a damn thing to protect them. The next day, someone cracked off a couple rounds at a buddy of mine. "Someone's shooting at me," he said calmly. "Pretty bad aim." The third day, another RPG was fired at the building while I was on post. This one hit the building, but it was a good 50 meters away from where I stood. It kicked up some dust and smoked the joint up a little bit, but no real damage. If there's one silver lining to this cat-and-mouse game we play here, it's that the Muj generally have poor aim. I say generally, but there have been some unfortunate exceptions. This is good, because if the RPG had been on target, even if my little sandbag cocoon halted the shrapnel, the shock would most likely have resulted in a concussion that would have done nothing for what my Arabic tutor Rania calls my labored Arabic pronunciation. The next section I just want to read a little bit of is from, and I feel compelled to read a section of this from every time I do read it. It's from the eulogy, which our platoon commander was killed in an ambush trying to save another guy that had gotten shot. So he had a big funeral back here in New York. It was a huge one because he was a state trooper. So there was a huge ceremony, the governor went and all that. But we had a little one for him, what we could, over there in Iraq. And I had been asked to, being in his platoon, to write the eulogy for him, which I guess was, was very helpful for me. I don't know if you ever, had a, I used the example of my grandfather passed away a while ago, and my grandmother, when we were all there, was obsessed with making sure that the napkins were all set for the dinner afterwards, and the plates were going to be just fine. And I wanted to say, Grandma, this doesn't make a lick of difference. They're coming, but for her, it was doing something, and it was staying busy and having something to focus on was therapeutic for her as opposed to, and so that's what this was like. I didn't even really acknowledge the fact that, I went right to writing the eulogy and occupied myself with that, and that actually helped me quite a bit in, during those few days right after the ambush. So I'm just going to pick this up and read a little bit of it from the middle. His advice on women was succinct, always the same and usually right on the money. Dump her, she'll screw your head up. I bet I'm not the only one here who wishes they had followed that astute tidbit when we were all stateside. Captain McKenna defended his Marines, even when we were wrong, and he listened most of the time. Only once did he dismiss entirely an earnest request from one of his squad leaders. Lance Corporal Glover was sprawled out face down in the road as a barrage of gunfire roared unabated from the north and the south. Sergeant Kienzer yelled to Captain McKenna, asking him to hold tight, wait for the up guns and vehicles to arrive before going to the downed Marine. It is hard to hear over the deafening cacophony created by the blast of gases escaping from muzzles, the crack of bullets as they pass overhead, the thud of lead rounds chipping away at brick and concrete, the concussion of grenades landing in the distance, and the buzz of quickened staccato voices flooding the radio. Despite all this, Captain McKenna heard Sergeant Kienzer, but he could not comply. One thing common to all forms of life, from the flies that travel so effortlessly from the chow vats to the porta-johns and back again, to you and me, one thing common to us all is an unshakable desire for self-preservation, to go on living. We're born with it, and eventually we will die with it. The ranks of those whose love for their fellow man is so great that they can, for a moment, forget about their own life to save another are paltry thin. Captain John McKenna stands proudly at the front of those thin ranks. This is a piece that, up until recently, the next piece we'd always decided not to read, but Alex talked to me before and said he thinks that it would be appropriate on account of the topic and the conversation that, is going to ensue later, especially from what he's familiar with, some of Chris's work. I thought this would be a good place to go, but generally I avoid reading it partially because of the language and partially because of the topic. So you have to excuse the really vulgar language. It was written at a time when I was kind of angry and sort of raw, and I hadn't been around civilized folk in a while, so I you kind of forget how to speak civilized, in a civil manner, but here goes. The whole place is fucked. If you catch me drunk and honest, that's what I'll tell you. The country is fucked, and its fucking people can all go get fucked. Of course, if you catch me sober, I might say it nicer, but that is what I mean. Everyone thinks I'm chock full of profound insight and earnest revelations to how we can pull the debacle in Babylon back into a rosy, manageable situation. Well, there's your revelation. The place is fucked. Sergeant McGee, the radio man said, Post 5 has three guys digging in the road on Route April. Anything else, I asked? That's it. Three guys in the road. One has a shovel. I told the watch officer. He agreed. I agreed. Shoot him, I said. Moments later, we heard the sputter of automatic gunfire. Then Post 5 reported, one of them is down. Our quick reaction force went out to get a handle on the situation. They reported back that one military-aged male was dead at the scene. He had been cleaning the gutter in front of his house, and we killed him. Surprisingly, it didn't bother me. That was surprising. I thought it would eat me up and take over my dreams at night, but I felt nothing. Well, I said, he should have known better than to be in the road with a shovel. Fuck him, let it be an example. Of course, an investigation was immediately put forth by our command. We made statements and explained our actions. A roadside bomb had been put in place near that spot 3 days earlier. 2 weeks prior, a post had seen an identical situation unfold and had done nothing about it. Two Marines lost limbs and two others were badly burned because the post didn't shoot. Did I feel bad about the mistake? No, I told you. Fuck 'em. The following day, I talked to the men about to go fill the posts around our perimeter. They're saying yesterday was a bad shoot. It wasn't. If they see one guy digging in the road and nothing happens, it leaves the enemy to believe that we are impotent. We are not. If that dead man's wife comes out today and tries to finish cleaning out that gutter, fuck her, shoot her too. How did I get there? How did I become such a callous, unremorseful bastard? I don't know. I really don't. See why I don't read that very often. Like, I don't even think I've read it to myself since writing it over a year ago. And the last piece, which is probably a favorite, it was reprinted on a few websites. It was picked up by another, another book that was a collection of blogs printed in that. Was written, after I'd gotten home, and I was about sort of going through the readjustment phase, coming back into society, sort of. I always use the example, and I don't think I put it in here, but that it's you come off of such an adrenaline rush. It's like the equivalent of skydiving every day, all day. It felt to me like when you're driving down the road at 55 on a highway, and all of a sudden you come up on a town, and there's a 30 miles an hour sign, and you got to slow way up, way down, and because you've been going 55, it feels like you're just going unnaturally slow, like you're barely moving, but you're still doing 35. And if you readjust, you realize that's a fine speed to be going through the town, but it just feels weird. So I guess that's kind of the best way to describe it. But so here are a few thoughts on that, and then we'll finish up with the reading. Because if I read any more, it'll be most of the book. I miss all the guys. If they were all around me, piled into bunk beds, I would be laughing right now. We always laughed no matter how lousy things were. You didn't think about the bad stuff. Well, you thought about it just enough to make jokes about it. One day, there were many actually, I was fairly certain I wasn't going to make it. Not just me, we all thought like that when things got bad. It wasn't paranoia. Three Marines had burned into nothing and one was found walking around alive, but still on fire, 2 days earlier, and we were going back to that same spot to show the world we weren't scared. Don't tell anyone, but we were. Elwell, I said to my driver, I have no clean laundry. Me neither. Where are we going with this? Well, I don't want my parents to get a box of dirty underwear and socks. All right, I see where you're going. You're saying that today isn't a good day for us to die. Well, I said, I don't want to be a pain in the ass. But if it's all the same to you, why don't we just die some other day? Fine, he said. I guess we'll just stay away from the roadside bombs today. But Sergeant, he continued paternally, you really should stay on top of your laundry. You're a sergeant, for Christ's sake. Somewhere around then, my girlfriend left me, or I pushed her away, more likely. I don't blame her. Love just happens sometimes. That's all. Everyone said that they were disgusted because it was the worst time for someone to have to deal with a breakup. They were so wrong. It was the most thoughtful thing she ever did for me. When else can you say, well, my girlfriend is banging some other dude. Who cares? At least I'm not on fire. When is the next patrol leave? If she had waited until I got home, when I would have had time to think and dwell on things,
Well, that would have been bad timing. The next day when we were leaving the wire, I told everyone in my vehicle, "Don't worry, boys, nothing can happen to us. I'm invincible right now." "What the fuck are you talking about?" "Well, think about it. There's no way God would let my ex-girlfriend and her lousy new boyfriend get my life insurance money." "It's still in her name, you moron? Why don't you change it?" "Because," I said, shocked at their ignorance, "then I wouldn't be invincible." I think that's enough for now.
I'll just talk for maybe 10 or 15 minutes on what we tried to do with this book. I spent 2 decades as a foreign correspondent covering conflicts starting 5 years in the war in El Salvador, the First Intifada, the Civil War in the Sudan, Yemen, Algeria, the First Gulf War, where I spent 3 months with 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, learned to boot, heard more stories about Chesty Puller, then went into Kuwait with them. At the end of the war, went into Basra with the Shiite rebels until I was captured and taken prisoner by the Iraqi Republican Guard. I like to say I was embedded with the Iraqi Republican Guard. Finally released to Baghdad, turned over to the last 24 hours, I was turned over to the Iraqi secret police, or Muhabarat, which is not an experience I'd wish on anyone in this room. Finally turned over to the Red Cross. Went on to become the Middle East bureau chief for the Time, New York Times. Spent a lot of time with the Kurds in the north. Made 2 trips into the marshes with the Shiite rebels out of Iran. And then, as if all of that wasn't enough, I volunteered to go cover the war in Bosnia, based in Sarajevo. The executive editor at the New York Times, when I told him that, said, "Well, I guess the line begins and ends with you." I covered that war, then went on to Kosovo, and then finally, just lost the kind of physical and emotional resiliency that it takes to leapfrog from war to war to war. I think it's something you touched upon. It has an addictive quality. I think war is probably the most potent narcotic invented by humankind. Soldiers and Marines call it a combat high, and it's real. And it infects not only those who are involved in the military, but aid workers, foreign correspondents, came back and really had to struggle with the poison that war is, what it does to individuals, what it does to societies, what it did to myself. Anybody who has been around repeated acts of violence, I probably carry within me hundreds of images of traumatic violence. My own period of recovery after returning from the Balkans was difficult. I think it probably took about 3 years for me to put my life together. Now, there are different types of wars, most of which I've covered. You have a classic, for instance, in the war in El Salvador, a classic essentially a civil war. It's an insurgency, but it's an indigenous insurgency fought between Salvadorans. You have the more conventional set peace between mechanized units. That's what I saw in the first Gulf War when we went into Kuwait. And then you have the wars like Iraq, which are the dirtiest, most unpleasant, and most intractable conflicts. Those are foreign occupations. Those are where foreign troops go into a territory where they don't speak the language, they're not from the culture, and they seek to impose their will by force. This is something that I had to deal with repeatedly when I was working out of Gaza in the West Bank with the Israeli forces. I think as Robert J. Lifton correctly points out, these types of conflicts, he called them atrocity-producing situations, because you are so physically, culturally, linguistically, and emotionally cut off from the people you're occupying. And because it is so dangerous, you heard, every time you go outside the wire, your life becomes at risk in Iraq. And you're fighting an elusive enemy. You know, one of the most fascinating things about covering even low-intensity conflicts is how rarely you see the people who are trying to kill you. I covered the war in El Salvador for 5 years, and it was a fascinating war as a reporter because we were constantly switching sides. We would be out, it was all on foot. We would be out with the army, and a few days later we would be with the FMLN guerrillas, who were very media savvy and would turn to all the television people at about 2 or 3 in the afternoon and want to know when their feed times were so they could get them back to the capital. And in that 5 years of conflict, I can remember, maybe I forget, but I only remember once actually seeing somebody aiming an M16 at me and the unit I was with to try to kill us. Not that I was under fire a lot, but actually seeing somebody shooting the gun. And it becomes very frustrating in a situation like Iraq, or as you see with Israeli forces in Gaza, when you suffer severe casualties and death within your unit, and yet you can that enemy remains a shadowy presence, one that you can't find. You heard the passage about shovels. Shovels are actually, all the alarm bells go off for soldiers and Marines in Iraq because shovels are what you use to dig holes to put IEDs in, which is why somebody carrying a shovel would be perceived as a target. The problem is that and this is something that Lifton writes about in his studies on the Vietnam War, which I think are applicable in many ways to the war in Iraq. The problem is that there's a very short leap psychologically from sort of, battling against those defined as the enemy and transforming everyone in the country into the enemy. And once you cross that line, then you change the dynamics of the war. Now, in every single conflict that I've covered, murder is part of war, and murder is distinct from killing in this way. Killing is the taking of life of somebody who has the capacity to do you harm. Murder is the taking of life of somebody who does not have the capacity to do you harm. And when you sink into essentially colonial occupations like this, where you're fighting an insurgency that operates in and is easily melts into a surrounding civilian populace, and you are allowed, as the occupation troops in Iraq are, to use phenomenally heavy weapons, belt-fed saws. These are light machine guns, 7.62, right? 50 caliber machine guns. These are, they're bullets about this big. Automatic grenade launchers. When you're allowed to unleash these kinds of weapons, which have massive firing rates, and he can probably give you the statistics, so many rounds per minute, in densely populated areas, then what we call collateral damage or civilian casualties become immense. And the situation in Iraq is such, the security situation is such, that as reporters, it's impossible now to work among the Iraqi civilians to try and determine actually what's happening on the ground. And I think that, I'm not actually opposed to embedding. I think that when you cover a war, I've never done it. I don't do it. I don't respond well to authority. So I've never been embedded. In the first Gulf War, I defied the pool system and shaved off all my hair and was given a uniform by the Marines. Fortunately for me, in the first Gulf War, the Army ran the press operations, and the Marine Corps, in their infinite wisdom, had decided that these press operations were yet another Army conspiracy against the Marine Corps. So I was accepted into the Marine units, even though I wasn't officially sanctioned, and then, of course, went into Kuwait with them. But I looked like a Marine, and the battalion commander was actually a wonderful man. I'm still in contact with him. He's now retired and lives in Washington, but just a great... I came away with a lot of... When the Marine Corps are... I think when the Marines are run well, they're really amazing units, and when they're not run well, it's a form of sadism. But this guy was great. He his second-in-command is his XO and his sergeant major, which is the top enlisted official in the battalion were all Vietnam veterans. And it was fascinating because they were deeply proud of the Marines, but they hated war in a way that only people who have been to war can hate war. And so the CO said that, okay, anytime the general comes over, he said, just back away, and if they ask questions, I'm going to tell them you're a reservist. so I was able to cover that war without being part of the official pool system. I filed by satellite phone. I'm an Arabic speaker, so I would come down. I had to get to a microwave with my phone and my Jeep. So I would come down from the front lines of Kuwait with my story and drive along the Tapline Road, which runs across the north of Saudi Arabia, until I would come to a small town, be able to call my story in. This drove the Pentagon officials handling the press crazy, including Dick Cheney, who was Secretary of Defense. And right before the Iraqi war, he published a list of the 14 reporters, prominent reporters, that he wanted expelled before the war began, of which I was, of course, at the top of the list. Unfortunately for Dick Cheney, they couldn't find me because I was sleeping in Arab homes. But I do think that, in fact, embedding is part of the story. One has to tell the story of the soldiers and Marines who are carrying out the conflict, because that is part of the landscape of war. But you cannot understand war unless you also tell the story of the victims. And remember that in a war zone, it's a tiny percentage, 1% or less, of people who actually carry weapons. And that division, when the order breaks down, when war becomes dominant within a society, is really a division between the all-powerful and the all-powerless. And we always used to say, as war correspondents, it takes 4 days, once you hand an automatic weapon to a 19-year-old kid, for that kid to become God. And essentially that heady capacity to revoke another person's charter to live on this earth. And it is it's intoxicating and alluring and seducing, and none of us are immune from it. And in much of my book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, is really a meditation, not on how horrible war is, although it is horrible, but how seductive it is. And I am deeply disturbed by the war in Iraq. I was very, my book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, came out in the fall of 2002, so I had a lot of media attention, was on programs like Charlie Rose and Fresh Air and stuff, and inevitably I would be asked about the drumbeat of war, about whether we should invade Iraq or not. Now, I was a news reporter for the New York Times. I understood very well that expressing a contrary opinion, denouncing the foreign policy, was a kind of professional suicide. But having spent 7 years in the Middle East and much of that time in Iraq, I think I, like most Arabists, understood that the vision of an Iraq that would accept democracy, and that democracy would emanate outwards from Baghdad and transform the Middle East, and that we would be greeted as liberators, mm-hmm. and that the oil revenues would pay for reconstruction, was a fantasy. It was a utopian vision, had no connection with reality. And so I was indeed very outspoken about the war at tremendous cost, finally, to my career at the Times, ending with a commencement address I gave just 2 weeks after President Bush landed on the aircraft carrier with mission accomplished at Rockford College, where I was booed off of the stage. Most of the crowd stood and began singing God Bless America and were weeping. They cut my microphone twice. You can watch it on YouTube. You can read the transcript online at Granta, which is sort of interesting because in italics they print from the tape what people shouted, including a woman who was screaming, "Atheist stranger." I believed and still believe that this is probably the worst foreign policy debacle in American history. That while the Vietnam War was a tactical mistake, in the sense that we went into Vietnam and it was misguided and wrong, and we backed away, but we were able to actually now have relatively good relations with Vietnam at the moment. The war in Iraq is a strategic mistake, and that the disruption of power within the region, the destruction of Iraq no longer exists and will never exist again as a unified country, is one that is going to have horrific consequences for us. I was just reading a very good piece, and I'm just going to read a couple statistics to you, in the American Journalism Review, which was following how the war is covered. I mean, one of the frightening things about the war is the complicity of the media, especially the cable news, in selling us the war. As long as it fit the narrative of heroism and glory and courage and honor, all those sort of abstract terms that I think after about 30 seconds of combat become hollow and probably obscene. The war has disappeared, especially from cable news channels like Fox that shove the war down our throats. It's now, you know, the third longest war in American history. It is costing us $12.5 billion a month. During the first 10 weeks of 2007, Iraq accounted for 23% of the news hole for all of network news. In 2008, this fell to 3%. And on the cable networks, it fell from 24 to 1%, according to a study by the Project for Excellence in Journalism. The war has virtually been rendered invisible, virtually disappeared. The Pew Center for the People and the Press just did a poll, and only 28% of Americans who were polled knew that 4,000 military personnel had been killed in Iraq. And so I don't go to war anymore for my mental and physical health, but I wanted to find a way to bring home the reality of that war and the stories of the civilians. You know, estimates range anywhere from 600,000 to 1.2 million Iraqi dead. And I think, you know, any of us who have been around weapons like 50 caliber machine guns or automatic grenade launchers can understand, because very rarely are these incidents investigated. Now, first of all, it's a little dangerous to start walking into shanty towns after you've blown the place up and take a body cam. And so I sought out. I spent 7 months seeking out, along with Leila El-Aryan, another reporter, 50 combat veterans from the war in Iraq. Very few officers, interestingly enough, right? And that fits. You know, the higher you get in the food chain, the bigger the sort of quota of bullshit, and the lower you get, the more. I mean, a lance corporal is probably usually going to tell you much more truth about war than the lieutenant colonel who's running his battalion. We worked a lot through Iraqi veterans against the war, but people were very hesitant to speak, partly because it unearthed very painful emotions. And I, you know, I come out of the culture, the traditional culture of the New York Times. I don't like the Barbara Walters, that kind of emotional pornography. How fast can I get them to cry? You know, when they broke down, and I think of the 50 interviews we did, all on the record, all of which are taped, almost everyone broke down. I turned the tape recorder off, and we waited until they had regained their composure. That's not what this story was about. What we set out to do was write about Iraqi civilians in, I think, the only way at this point that is possible for an American journalist, and that is through the eyes of veterans. And we asked these people to speak about the deaths and maiming and wounding of unarmed Iraqi civilians that they either witnessed or, in many cases, participated in. And we sought to get a critical mass of 50 veterans to talk about patterns of the war. We focused on some of the key fundamental elements of the war, checkpoints, very dangerous for Iraqis, convoys. In Iraq, you have to keep moving all the time. If you stop moving, even if an IED doesn't go off at a choke point, you can be sure 2 or 3 days later an IED will go off at that choke point. So convoys race down the middle of streets, often in the middle of the meridian, slamming into Iraqi vehicles, running over Iraqi civilians without stopping. They are freight trains of death for an Iraqi. We talked about detentions. We talked about suppressing fire. What happens after an IED goes off? You have very frightened, understandably, young kids armed with very powerful weapons that were not designed for urban warfare, unleashing, you know, raking whole neighborhoods full of fire. We put together from these interviews a 15,000 word story that appeared in the end of July in The Nation, dominated the entire issue, and then we expanded that story to write this book, that essentially I think creates another narrative about the war, one that I think that we as Americans haven't faced up to. It was very much coming out of the idea of Winter Soldier, if anyone has seen that great documentary on the Vietnam War. And the response was fascinating, because at first the right wing tried to go after it, but they couldn't, because everybody was on the record. If they wouldn't speak on the record, we wouldn't talk to them. And we were very careful. Part of the laborious effort of verifying facts was we went back and asked the Pentagon to verify the service records so that we knew people were actually in Fallujah or Nasiriyah or Basra when they said they were. When they came at us, the best they could do is say that we took quotes out of context, and we had typed up all the transcripts, literally hundreds of pages, and then we just put them, the entire transcripts, up on the website of the Nation, and they backed off. What you got, in essence, from the article was a kind of deafening silence. NBC came, interviewed several of the veterans that we had interviewed us, and it never aired. And contrast that with the reaction in Europe. The Guardian newspaper picked up the entire 15,000 words and reprinted it. The Independent printed most of it. The BBC ran a series of programs on it, and I think it was just finally, at this point, too difficult for Americans to confront the reality of what's being done in our name in the war, to overcome that sort of knee-jerk, stereotypical idea of heroism, and to look at the seamier, uglier side of this conflict, one, by the way, that is wreaking tremendous emotional and physical havoc on the people who have to carry out this work, and not only have to carry it out, but are being sent back for a second and third time to be re-traumatized. So the consequences of the war in the Middle East, the consequences of the war for our veterans, the consequences of the war for Iraqis, for me, are criminal. Certainly under international law, under post-Nuremberg laws, this war is defined as a criminal war of aggression. We have no right to be there. We have no right in this election campaign to discuss the terms of the occupation. It is morally, and I think finally politically, incumbent upon us to demand immediate withdrawal. You know, there are three major demands of Iraqi veterans against the war, all of which I support. And the first is immediate withdrawal. The second is the payment of reparations to Iraq. And the third is adequate care for those veterans who return who are physically and emotionally maimed. And I, for one, am not going to vote for any presidential candidate. And right now, there aren't any in the mainstream parties that don't embrace those demands. War and Iraq, these are not abstractions to me. And the fact that we can shove it all under the rug, and I blame much of this on the media, and pretend it's not existing, especially given the level of violence and level of atrocity that is being visited on the Iraqi people, is really shameful for our country. Thank you.